How you doing? I'm Jack Humphrey. This is High Performance, our conversation for you every single week. This podcast reminds you that it's within. Your ambition, your purpose, your story, it's there. We just help unlock it by turning the lived experiences of the planet's highest performers into your life lessons. We speak to the greatest leaders, thinkers, entrepreneurs, and in this case, sports stars on the planet, so they can be your teacher. And for the first time since we launched the High Performance Podcast, Damien Hughes is flying solo, ladies and gentlemen. Yet, welcome to the first of our special episodes to celebrate the Rugby League World Cup. And over the next few weeks, Damien is going to be speaking to some of the greatest people ever involved in the sport. And Damien has a really rich heritage when it comes to rugby, both union and league. He's consulted some of the most famous teams. He's been to World Cups. He knows this sport inside out. And we actually start with a really, really special episode. This is what's coming your way on this Rugby League World Cup special of the High Performance Podcast.
And I had a couple of things happen early in my life that, you know, with my father getting sick and then having to care for him, that really accelerated me. My desire to succeed, because I had to succeed to be able to fund my life and help care for my father. For me, because he didn't want me to see the dark side of the disease. And for me, he was showing me how much he loved me. He went through that, you know, to show me that it'll always be all right, you know. And for me, that taught me how to love. He did that through love, I think. And Russell just pulled out of his pocket a membership card. Oh, I'm going to get choked up. He had my father's name on it and a couple of things he used to say to me before each game. I just didn't expect it. I didn't know where it came from. And I just burst into tears on the field. And he presented it to me and he said, "No, this is your father's seat in the stadium. It's next to mine. I sit here. It'll be left empty. If you're ever in doubt or you want to see him, just look to that seat. It'll be in the stadium forever." When I became a captain or a dominant leader in my teams throughout my career, I would often ask my team to have arrogance. I believe you need a certain level of internal arrogance. Ultimately, I put it down to this question: would you rather be my friend and lose, or would you rather just not be happy with me and win?
So get ready to hear from Sam Burgess, a normal guy from Bradford who became a modern day gladiator in this most remarkable of sports. And actually, you're going to hear some very special stories from Sam Burgess. He'll talk about everyday habits that you need to adopt. We will talk about coaches that he's worked with and some amazing stories about Russell Crowe and what Russell did to make him feel welcome when he joined Russell's team. And there's a big lesson for everybody there. This is a really fantastic episode. Just a quick reminder, we know that most people that listen to the High Performance Podcast don't actually subscribe to the High Performance Podcast, and we would love you to do that. So wherever you're listening to this, if you can just do us one favor, please hit the subscribe button, hit the follow button, and enjoy this episode of the High Performance Podcast, Professor Damien Hughes talking to Sam Burgess. Enjoy.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. You know, you think, have I really been living like that for so long? It's a bit like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. You just think, wow, how have I been affording to pay so much more? It is time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text and data for $15 a month. And the quality of their mobile service in comparison to your old provider is special. You could be saving so much money. So say goodbye to the overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, unexpected overages. You can use your own phone number, bring along all your existing contacts, and ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal, where you get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/HPP. That's mintmobile.com/HPP. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/HPP. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gig on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So, Sam, we always kick off these podcasts with the same question: what is high performance?
Well, I think there's a couple of different ways you can view high performance. You know, for me individually, high performance was about just reaching your potential. I mean, that's always been a goal throughout my career, is to, you know, not waste talent, not waste time, not waste opportunity. So for me, high performance was making the most of myself, my mind, my physical attributes, and then what I can contribute to a team in that sense. But yeah, I think on a grand scale, high performance collectively is being able to channel everyone's performance, so to speak, in one singular direction. And if you can get on the same path to achieve the same goal, I think that's probably what I would say high performance is, getting everyone to believe in the same goal.
So let's talk about your potential then, because we've got some history. When I think about you, I always think of, you know, that scene in Jurassic Park where
I don't watch Jurassic Park. Go on, you'll have to explain it to me.
Well, there's a scene where, like, there's a guy with a cup of water and the water starts to ripple.
Yeah.
And you can hear this sort of thud of the dinosaur coming up behind them. And I always think of you in that regard, because I heard about you.
Yeah.
Long before I ever met you. So
yeah, right.
I'd hear people like John Bastian or Tony Smith or Steve McNamara would say to me, oh, you wouldn't see this kid coming through at Bradford.
Yeah, right.
So you were somebody that had a huge amount of potential or seen as recognising it. And I'm interested in terms of, when did you know you were good, and how did you sort of put in place the structures to maximise that potential?
I won't say I ever knew I was good. I got to a point where, you know, I was very ambitious, really young, and I had a couple of things happen early in my life that, you know, with my father getting sick and then having to care for him, that really accelerated my desire to succeed, because I had to succeed to be able to fund my life and help care for my father. So that, you know, when you're put in a position like that where there's no other choice, you can't really accept failure. It did accelerate me, I think, as a player and as a person. But I never really felt the pressure of, well, this guy's good, he's got a lot of potential, because, you know, people weren't really saying it to me. I had a really good family, it kept me grounded. But I always had a desire to, you know, reach the top, which was, you know, playing in the first grade. And then once I hit first grade, I realised, oh, actually, I'm not far off these guys.
Yeah.
A couple of years in at this place, I want to try and get right to the top. So reaching my potential, I guess, just became a day-to-day thing, just trying to always improve, learn, and grow as much as I could along the way.
Yeah. So let's go and explore some of those topics, because there's a couple of that are really fascinating areas. The one about your dad always intrigues me. Just tell us a little bit more around your dad and about his illness and what subsequently.
Yeah, well, my father was diagnosed with motor neuron disease. I struggle to think when we were told that he had MND. I seem to think it was around the time I was 15 or 16, so coming towards the end of school. And when I finished school, I went straight into a full-time position at Bradford Bulls.
Yeah, but your dad had been a rugby player as well.
Yeah, my dad was a rugby player himself. He was he'd coached all of me. I have three brothers, Thomas, George, and Luke. He'd coached all of us at some stage in our junior career at Dewsbury Moor, and he's just a wonderful man. He's great, caring. He's gentle. He was great coach, good father, good friend, all the things you'd want in a father. And he was a big, strong man. He's, you know, he was 18 stone. He was a front rower himself when he played. So, you know, he was a strong man. So when he sat us down to tell us that he had motor neuron disease, I didn't think a lot of it. I didn't know what it was, what it meant. So for a couple of weeks, I just got on with life as usual and as normal. But then I decided to, it was actually one of my brother's partners said, listen, you should take a look at this disease. It's serious. So we had me and Luke one day, we looked online and, you know, we figured out it was a terminal illness. And then that's when it got a bit serious for us. You know, and as time progressed, my father's illness, you know, accelerated really quickly. And within 18 months to 2 years, he was gone. So, you know, in that time, I'd finished school. I was trying to make it as a professional athlete. Me and my father lived together at the time and became his sole carer, which was a bit of a task. Yeah. But at the time, I didn't understand how hard a task it was, what I was actually doing. I was care for my father all day. I'd go to train in the morning. I had great next-door neighbours, and my mum and brothers would help as well, but I had a nice woman down the street that would come and help clean the house. And whilst I'd be at training, they'd come and sit with my dad, and then I'd come home and sort of be with my dad. And in amongst all that, I was trying to become a professional athlete, which I ended up playing. My goal was to be a first-grade player before my dad passed away. And thankfully, I managed to play, I don't know, maybe I think 15 games for Bradford before, maybe a few more before
he
passed away.
What age were you, 17? When that?
Yeah, 18 when he passed away. But I made my debut for Bradford at 17 in 2006. And dad passed away in the middle of 2007.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that was the happiest times for my dad. He'd get to come down to the stadium, we'd get him in the grounds, and he'd love watching his son play rugby league. You know, the one of the only sad things about it is my three brothers never became professional athletes whilst dad was around, which is sad, but, you know, it's they've gone on to have such wonderful careers since then. So it's
been good. So tell us about that, Kevin, because, I mean, you're describing it in really pragmatic terms that you got on with it and just did it. But actually, there's an awful lot of demands that are being placed on you there. So what were the kind of things you were having to do for your dad?
Well, as the disease progressed, it got down to everything, really. My father, he becomes just a vessel. He's in a wheelchair. I have to carry him up and down the stairs. Still lived in the same house. To wash him, help him, you know, he wasn't eating food towards the end. It's, you know, absolutely everything. I learned how to cook through the 6 months. My dad was a great cook.
Yeah.
You know, then he also, I look back now as an adult, as a father, and what he actually was doing for me in those 12 or 18 months, he was preparing me for the rest of my life, which it's actually really, when I look back at it, I go, wow, he was more intelligent than I thought. But he was teaching me how to run a house, how to cook, how to clean, how to manage. But we did it in a fun, loving, caring way.
Yeah.
But he was definitely preparing me for the rest of my life. He knew that he had a short space of time to get me ready for the rest of my life. And that's essentially what I did. But in terms of care, it had to do almost you caring for two bodies, really. He, you know, each night he'd sleep with a breathing apparatus on, and you know, if that breathing apparatus came off, his chance he's not there in the morning, so I'd end up sleeping next to him in bed. And it's just, you know, it was a loud, horrible machine, but you know, we just got used to that way of life. You know, but in terms of care, it was just what was required at the time. There's no other choices.
So when you look back then at that period, but like, I know you say your dad's preparing you for life in terms of the practical things of cooking and managing a house. What kind of values did it teach you though that you can look back on now many years later and recognise that actually I learned something really useful there that I'm still using today?
Well, the greatest lesson I learned out of that time in my life was that you know, the simple things in life are so important. You know, I look back at what made me happy, him happy, in some of the hardest times I've been through. were the simplest things. Going to Morrison's, getting out of the house, going to Morrison's, doing his shopping and just being outdoors. He built a conservatory on the back of the house, and when it rained, he used to love sitting in the conservatory, listening to the rain hit the roof and listening to Norah Jones. And for those, looking back at those moments, those were the simplest times with, you know, no frills, nothing special, but that's what made him happy, sitting in the back and in the sunshine there as well with the doors open, listening to the birds tweet. So for me, it always gave me a, you know, when my life's been chaotic over the past 15 years, it's always been a great place for me to go back and go, get back to the simple things in life that really mean, you know, what really means something to you. It's being around your family. You know, and he also taught me, you know, compassion, really, to be compassionate and to be loving.
Go on, tell us more about that.
Well, you know, my father, for such a big, strong man, he was a very soft, gentle, caring man as well. And in those last 12 to 18 months, he never once complained. He never once was angry. He very rarely got upset. You know, and he was always happy and he would always joke. And I know he was doing that for me because he didn't want me to see the dark side of the disease.
Right.
And for me, he was showing me how much he loved me. He went through that, you know, to show me that it'll always be all right. You know, and for me, that taught me how to love. He did that through love, I think. So.
Wow. So tell us then, you're learning all these lessons, you've been immersed in learning about the simple things, learning to love and show vulnerability for others. And you're going into like an adult world, a hugely competitive world at Bradford Bulls at 17, where you're getting this immersion in a rugby education, and yet you're getting an education in life at home. Tell us about those early experiences then when you go into Bradford. You're a 17-year-old prodigy, you've got this huge potential. What was that like?
Well, it's freedom for me at the time, if I'm honest. You know, home life was hard. As much as I talk about that with great enthusiasm, it was really hard when I look back at it. So that time away from then, going into that environment, the high-performance environment, chasing a dream of becoming a professional athlete, for me, that was a tiny bit of freedom in my life. So it gave me an opportunity to, my thoughts weren't so clouded. I didn't overthink my position, what my potential is. For me, it was a place to go in, be around a group of guys that were fun, happy, we're all striving to be better. So for me, it was a place to go and be free, train, work as hard as I could, have some fun, you know, be a child at times. So it was, you know, the more I look back at my career in those early years, it certainly shaped how I approach turning up every day to training. Happy, grateful, all those sorts of words.
And who took you under your wing at that time and sort of and gave you an education in being an elite rugby player?
There was actually a few. I was so fortunate at Bradford Bulls at the time. In the early parts of my career, I was surrounded by some great men. But, you know, in that group of men, I had such a great mix of leadership, friendship, everything. So, with Andy Lynch at training, he was the ultimate professional. He taught me discipline, extras, routine. In the car, I had Joe Vagnar. It was almost like he was a big cuddly teddy bear. He taught me how to be happy and joke around and have fun and cuddle and not take things too seriously. Glenn Morrison, ultimate competitor. Like, he would compete at everything, 100 miles an hour. So I'm watching and learning this guy. Shontaine Harpy was skillful and jazzy and fun and wore cool clothes. And he was a bit glitz and glam. And Leslie was a rock star. You know, he was powerful. He would compete on every game. I think he scored 150 tries in 148 games for Bradford. So amongst the five players that I really probably looked up to and around, I had such a wide group of personalities, really. And as a young child, as a young man, I had a knack of taking what I liked from each one, like a bit like a sponge. I used to say the sponge analogy. I'd soak up what I wanted and squeeze out what I didn't.
Because what always intrigues me about that period, Sam, is that you went in there and weren't cowed by it. You weren't intimidated by that. Like, when I watch you always look like you thrived in it, that you were open to it. And that, to me, was your superpower at that time, that you weren't going in there and being intimidated by going into this environment.
Yeah, it's funny. I've never thought of it like that. Never entered my mind to be intimidated. I felt really comfortable around the players. And I did feel like I had a bit of respect amongst them for some reason.
Yeah.
When I spoke, they'd listen. Or when I had a question, they would answer me with integrity. You know, I'd see some other interactions, but I always seemed to listen a little bit more.
Yeah.
So then, in turn, you feel more comfortable in that space. Then I also started playing really young, and I felt like I could add to the team. I was very adamant that I could add to the team. I was a thorn in Steve Mack's backside, I think, in my early years. I'll tell you a story. So I was very confident that I could add some value to the team, and I was desperate to play first team. I didn't know when my dad was going to, and I was desperate, okay? Like, and when you're faced with a desperate man, it's a person you don't want to face every day because they're willing to do anything. And that was me at that point. So I was playing in the under-20s, and they'd held me back in the preseason to try and get me a bit stronger and build my levels of strength and everything up so I could try and push through at some point in my career. Now, I ended up saying to the club, I said, I need to play, I need the money. I need, you know, if I need the win bonus to play in the 20s, so I've got bills to pay, I've responsibilities. So they start applying me. I played 2 or 3 games. I was feeling good. So I knocked on Steve Mack's door. I said, I think I can play in your first team. I'm ready to play.
You said that too.
Yeah. I said, I'm ready to play. I think I can add to the team. I can could do a better job than a couple of players. And he said, oh, no, you look, Sam, you know you can't. You've got to go and work on this. I said, all right, what do I need to work on? You know, in market defence, you sometimes get a bit lazy. The top grade, you can get caught out. Yeah. I said, no problem. My next game I played, I would nail that side of my game. I go in next Monday, knock on his door. Steve, I'm doing it perfect. Look, showing stuff. I'm not going to let you down. I'm going to do a job for you. No, you've got to. Next week, sometimes when the ball goes this way, you can switch up, you know. Okay, no worries. I'm going to be perfect in that area of my game. So I go be perfect and knock on his door. Steve, I can add something to your team. I can do a better job than someone in the team. I know I can bring you more. But he's thinking, what is this kid talking about? I was 17 and look back and think he's mad. But, you know, the persistence got me there in the end. I played 9 games of under 20s and then I went straight into the first team and that's it after that. But I didn't play any reserve grade, I didn't play anything like that. But I was very fortunate how I got my start. One of the players, Matty James actually was in the team. Playing Leeds at Leeds, which was a huge game. I just had a feeling it was my time because in the captain's run the night before, I jumped in, which you really don't do. I was 18th man. I jumped in. I did a set or two practice. I just must have had a feeling. The next morning, about 9 o'clock, Steve called me up. He said, how are you feeling? I said, yeah, I'm good. He said, do you think you could play tonight? I said, yes. Yeah, I do. I was lying in bed. I was like, yeah, I do. He said, well, you're in the team. Matty James is sick. I said, great. That's great. I'll see you there tonight. Ran downstairs, said, Dad, I'm playing tonight. I'm playing Headland, I'm making my debut.
And what was your dad's reaction to that?
Yeah, no, it was just, I think he expected it.
Did it?
My dad was calm, you know, he was a very calm man. He just, it's great, son, you deserve it. You've worked hard, you know, he was just good. And for me, it was like, that's what I was chasing that game. That's all I wanted. I just wanted that one game. So I played my debut at Headingley in front of a packed out crowd. It's 26,000, 27,000 people out. And I'll never forget going out for warm up and looking over to see Lee. And Jamie Peacock was one of my idols as a kid growing up. And he was warming up on the other side of the field. We're talking and I couldn't hear anyone. And the first time that happens in your career, it's a really unfamiliar feeling because we used to play in under-20s games. You can hear everyone in the crowd.
Yeah.
It's your mum and dad trying, get your tackles right, you know. But this game, you can't hear a thing. It's a buzz, you know. And at Headingley, they're a couple of metres away from the field. It's just a magical place to play. And I guess that was it. I was in. I'd got in the squad and I played my debut and, I mean, from then on, I played first grade. I never came out of first grade.
So take us in that dressing room then, because I've been in dressing rooms where you see kids making the debut, and I think sometimes it's almost like they look like competition winners. Do you know what I mean? Like they're looking around thinking, do do I deserve to be here? And you sort of seeing people that you've idolised. And what's going on for you in that dressing room before you walk out there?
Well, I can't remember the exact detail of how I felt in the sheds. I remember how I felt when I ran on the field.
Go on.
And I remember looking around, I was just like euphoric. Like, wow, this is it. This is what it feels like. And it was great. It was a magical feel. I'm looking over at the other team, going, oh, I like watching that player play. It's good, you know. And then I'm thinking, I want to get that player. I want a piece of him, you know.
Yeah.
And that was how my mind used to work. So, you know, I wanted a piece of Jamie. Like, I was a 17-year-old kid. He was a Greyburn captain. I wanted a piece of him. I don't know where that came from, whatever, maybe my competitive edge, but it's just such a surreal feeling. And then when I finally got on the field, you know, I added a bit to the team. As I told Steve Mack I would. I said I can add to the team. In my first debut, I added more defensively than I did offensively. But I kept telling him I could be more a better offensive player. I could play better on the ball for him. But in my debut, I was defensively better than I was offensively. So
if anyone's listening to this, then, Sam, and they're thinking that what you're describing is a real innate sense of confidence that I can do this and I can add value, how do you walk that line between either being arrogant or delusional of thinking that you're better than you are and actually just being really blunt and honest that I am as good as I say I am?
Well, I mean, look, it's very easy to sit and talk about it now when it's been and gone, but at the time, it wasn't an outward confidence. My conversations I'd had with Steve Mack are behind a closed door, and it's just in my head. And it's just how I speak with Steve, and I was just frank.
Yeah,
I wasn't out saying that to everyone else. It was just internal conversations the whole time. Right. Now, and what made me believe and have the confidence to say that to Steve is I didn't think I was delusional because I had a good gauge on what was happening around me.
Yeah,
I trained extremely hard. I could see how much I was my input, and I could see input everywhere else. I didn't believe it was a delusional thing. I certainly had confidence, but it was an internal confidence.
Yeah.
And whether you want to say it's an arrogance or an internal arrogance, I was never outwardly.
No.
Because in the environment I was brought through in, you get knocked out of you pretty quick if you are. And in the family that I was in, it was just not how we were brought up, you know. You know, we were taught always to believe in yourself. But if you ever stepped out of line or made that belief into arrogance, then you got it smacked out of you pretty quick. So, but there is a line. I do believe there is a line, and it's a line that you know, I've certainly battled with it through my career, and more so in a team's perspective, when I became a captain or a dominant leader in my teams throughout my career, I would often ask my team to have arrogance. I believe you need a certain level of internal arrogance.
Yeah, yeah.
Not never external, but when you get on that field, you have to have that belief, or you have to have some part of your ego that's saying, we're not losing today. There is a line with that, and you know, we see athletes step over it all the time. But you know, I think throughout my career, I was pretty good at holding the line of just being confident in my own ability.
Yeah. So you go on then, you make your debut, you establish yourself, you're 18, you get called up by Great Britain for that first series against New Zealand.
Yeah.
Did that feel a step up again for you?
Yeah, that was the next year. Whoa, I'm playing against people from Australia now and New Zealand. I think I was the second youngest player to ever play, but then the first youngest player to ever start. I started in the front row in my test debut with Adrian Morley as my other front rower and Jamie Peacock as my captain and left edge back rower. So for me as a 18-year-old boy, I'm a yucky young man. It was a surreal place to be. That's where you start thinking, whoa, should I be here right now? Do I fit in this group? Am I at this level yet?
Right.
So there is that self-talk of, wow, this is a big step up. You know, I've been used to playing the Super League around people that I'm comfortable with, whereas now you're going into a new environment with complete players that you've competed against all year, almost learnt to hate throughout the year, and then now you've got to play a game with them against the Kiwis. You know, so you do have, I certainly had a tiny bit of self-talk in those early moments in my career. But
so what were you saying to yourself then?
So geez, am I going to be good enough? Will I be strong enough? Have I done enough work? You know, it's a lot of internal communication like that. But
right.
I was very fortunate. I was really lucky too. I got a lot of good breaks in my career early.
So let's just stop there, Sam, in terms of There's a really interesting bit here that a lot of young players talk about playing with freedom and almost that naivety when they go into like the early stages of their career. And that's what you've described in lots of ways. I often think the key then to sustain a career is the ability then to cope with pressure and expectation. You know, when you know you're starting, when people know your name, you could start developing a reputation. Mm. How did your thinking change from those early days then of going in with that almost that youthful naivety to then eventually coping with all those demands?
I never actually felt personally a great deal of pressure to perform for external people or external reasons. I mean, you know, a lot of my pressure was, you know, my own pressure or my own expectation of myself or my expectation to give back to the team or to my coach that I'm playing for at the time. But it's certainly true when you come in, you're free. People look at you a bit differently, you're younger. They might just brush past you in the preparation, so you might get away and you might be able to sneak up on people. But for me, I came in pretty hot and hard.
Yeah.
So I was on everyone's mind pretty quick. So I learned early that to stay in front of the game, I had to keep developing, keep adding bits to my game, out-thinking players, you know, being able to work out where I can get an advantage on my opposition or on different players within the game. That's something I progressed over my career. It wasn't, especially when I got to Australia.
Yeah.
When I finally got, everything's on TV, the press are everywhere, you're scrutinised, praised on everything you do. That's when I learned really how to really fine tune that skill.
Go on, tell us more about that.
Well, you know, whilst I was playing in England, there'd be, I think, 3 games a week maybe on TV, and not everything's broken down or evaluated and dissected. Yeah. Whereas when I moved to Australia and I went over there with big profile, my game was scrutinised, and being an English player in the NRL following Adrian Morley, who'd gone over there and trailblazed it, and Gareth Ellis was actually currently there and doing a great job. Then I was a young player that came over, you know, with a big reputation. I'd already played maybe 10 or 12 test matches by then. I'd just scored a double against the Aussies in 2009 in a final. I scored 2-1 from halfway line, which is probably the longest try I've ever scored. But I did against the Aussies in a final.
Yep.
So the Aussies stood up and said, hang on, who's this kid? You know, we're going to keep our eye on him. So I understood when I got there, I got off the plane, I landed in Sydney. There would have been 20 cameras at the airport waiting for me when I got into the country, which was it's a weird feeling because it's not like that here.
Yeah,
I had to go. I said, I'll go straight to the club. I want to go straight to the club. I want to meet the players.
Yeah,
I had to do a press conference. It was actually my 21st birthday too, 14th of December. So I went to the club. I did a press conference. I am here. It's nice to be in Australia. And then I went down into the changing rooms. I met all the players. And they were doing an afternoon session with the under-20s. I didn't have any boots with me. So I asked the team manager, I said, if you can get me some boots, I want to train today. I want to train with the team. So that was my introduction to Australia. So I trained the first day I landed, and I trained for the week before Christmas and integrated myself into the team. But I understood extremely early that, wow, you're on show here all the time. You have to be on your game all the time.
So what kind of challenges did they throw up at you? Because I imagine you've got a big target on your back now.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, the other teams and players, they want to test out your toughness. I had a great friend in my mind saying, listen, they're going to come for you. You've got to get ready. So this whole time I'm working myself up. I remember I played Wayne Bennett picked me in the NRL All-Stars team before I played a game in Australia.
Right.
Which I thought was, you know, is very random, but he is a very clever coach, and I think he just wanted to put me in that environment, so he picked me with the top 20 players in the NRL to play against the top 20 Indigenous players in the NRL. I'd never played in the NRL before. So I'm playing with Cam Smith, Darren Lockyer against Jonathan Thurston, Greg Inglis, and it was just like, it was an amazing experience. But in that game, my same friend saying, mate, they're coming for you. they're going to come and try and bash you. They want to fight you. So all week I'm working myself up for this.
Yeah.
I got into this game, and the first bit of confrontation, I wanted to fight. You know, but yeah. I think it set the tone of who I was and what I was bringing to the competition.
See, but I love that idea that you've just described, this friend in my head.
Yeah.
Tell us, like, explain what you mean by that.
It was one of my friends. It was one of my great friends, a person that I respect a lot, who's watched a lot of NRL.
Right.
And he was constantly, we'd speak almost daily at the time. He was constantly telling me that, you know, you've got to be on your game. You're English. You're the big, you know, play for South Sydney. We're a huge club. You know, Russell Crowe's the owner. They're going to want a piece of you. Russell Crowe brought me to Australia.
I want to come to him.
Yeah, they're going to want a piece of you. So I'm getting more and more worked up. I'm thinking they all want to kill me. They all want to fight me, you know. So my first game, I made a big tackle. Someone came in and pushed me. I stood up and my reaction was to, like, all right, protect.
Yeah.
And I got ready to, we never had a fight, but I think everyone said, whoa, this guy it might be like you can't get on top of this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a good place for me to start.
See, but that's very different though, isn't it? From like when you've come in at Bradford, like you're the one setting your own internal expectations and you're the one targeting, I'm going to go after Peacock, I'm going to go after the big names and have a piece of them.
Mm.
So you've gone from being the hunter to being the hunted.
Yeah.
What does that do for your mindset?
It was actually good. When you're the hunted, like I think you dot your I's and you cross your T's with a bit more energy, and you're on edge. Like when you're the hunted, you've got to keep everything looking. You've got to look around. You've got to be on your game the whole time. When you're the hunter, sometimes you might get a bit complacent, or there might be, you know, maybe every now and then. So being the hunted didn't actually work too bad for me. I coached this year.
Yeah,
I coached in my first year as a head coach, and I use this term, one of my main phrases throughout the year. The team that I coached had not been very successful for the past decades. They were almost not respected within the competition that I coached. And I said that they were the hunted. I called them the hunted. And I said, no more. I said, we're now the hunters. I said, we will be the hunters of this competition. I said, we will get the respect of this whole league. I said, we are no more the hunters. We are now the hunters. And that was our motto for the year.
Yeah, yeah.
That, you know, so they called themselves the hunters and they really loved it. So it's funny you brought that up there. So it's funny, if they ever watch this, they'll really enjoy that.
So were you actually doing that? So although people are hunting you, were you still having that hunter mindset of were you identifying who are the big dogs? I'm going to go after them. I'm going to make my mark against them. Or was it more just, I'm going to set my own standards and I'm not worried what anybody else does?
It was a tiny bit of both. In the beginning, I didn't really set that intention of, all right, I want this guy, but I was a very competitive player.
Yeah.
I had my own... my own goals and outcomes that I wanted. But also, as a collective, I'd gone to a team that were not renowned to win. Like, they were bottom, middle of the table.
Yeah.
Not won a premiership for 40 years. So, although I had my mindset, I was conscious of growing the mindset of everyone around me in the environment and the organisation that I went to. So, as much as I'm thinking win, perform, hit my standards, it was also about, all right, how can I influence the other 25 guys to get somewhere near my way of thinking? Because it's kind of pointless me being in that mindset if
it's
another. So my thinking became wider almost instantly when I got to Australia. I don't know why, I just felt like in England I was in a winning environment. I came from a winning culture, and then I went to a culture that wasn't a winning culture. So I quickly learned to go, all right, well, I got to expand. I got to learn to influence a bit quicker. That was my framework. But you get in a game of rugby league, you know, someone in that game would be trying to stamp their authority on the game and go, okay, well, that's the guy that I want a piece of that guy. Or I could flow in and out of being the hunter or the hunted, or, you know, or wanting to assert my authority on someone or not, depending on how the game was flowing.
I love that, because that reminds me of an interview we did with a guy called Sia Khaleesi, who is the Springboks captain in Rugby Union. Yeah. And he talks about how he doesn't need to be the vocal leader at the front. So like sometimes he'll hand it over to other members of the team and say, you're better qualified, you speak here, and I'll sit out. So you've gone in there as a leader, the focal point, the big signing from England coming in, and yet you're describing how you can sort of float in and out and develop the mindset in others. Now, there's lots of people listen to this podcast that are interested in how do you get others to come with you? It's great being a high performer yourself, but how do you get others to adopt that? So give us some of the ideas or the techniques you did to raise the standards at Selfs when you went in there.
How I personally thought I helped raise standards, I had to really let them know that I was there to win first. I had to let my team, I had to let my players know that, all right, I was there to win. And then it gave me the platform, the foundation to be able to say, to challenge them when I didn't believe they were doing the right things. I don't think if I had their respect or if I don't think if I made my intentions clear that I was there to win, that I could have that platform or foundation to be able to challenge them in areas that they've probably not been challenged before. But you know, it's a great story that I've not told very often. My first year at South Sydney, we did okay. We were better than we were the year before, but we weren't where we needed to be. And we were playing St. George, who ended up going on to win the competition that year. We were playing them the last game of the season at St. George, and we had to beat them by 4 points to make the finals. I was the ultimate optimist. I thought there's no way we're going to lose the game. So gone in supremely confident. And their back rower, Ben Cray, scored a hat-trick in the first half over a certain player on an edge. And I realised they're not ready to win yet. We didn't have that steely focus, the mentality to win. We weren't ready. We didn't want to. We lose this game. We're on our holidays. You win this game, I've got another week of training. You win another, you could have a potential.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but to me, it wasn't about the holidays or time. It was about winning, becoming better, and eventually winning a championship. So after that game, I evaluated who I thought was ready to win with a couple of other people, and we sat down and we said, listen, I think these guys are in it to win, or these guys are not.
So you as a playing group, you and a few of the other players had this chat?
Yeah, one other player and two of the administration.
Right, okay.
Yeah, said, I think these players are in to win. I don't think these guys are. So if we're going to win, we should replace a few of these guys.
So what were you, like, what was your assessment based on then? So you're making those judgment calls?
On a feeling.
Right.
I mean, when you're out on the field and when you're in such close proximity to these people for so long, you go through so many emotions together. You win, lose, you're injured, disappointment, selection, not selection. That's a lot of emotion to go through, and you're close with these people. You learn to understand them, and you learn to like know what makes them tick. You learn about the person. So you become very in tune with these, you know, with 25 people. So you kind of, I think you figure them out. And then when it came to crunch time in some of the bigger games, a lot of the characteristics that you might have had in your mind, they were exposed in the big moments.
So it reminds me, again, as you're talking on this, that I know we're going to talk about your experience on like the SAS program in Australia, but one of their criteria for selection is simply, do I want to be stood next to you when the shit hits a fan?
Yeah.
Was that similar to the kind of questions you were asking at that time?
Yeah, that's exactly the question we were asking.
Because this is a period of your career then that fascinates me, because as like we were saying for people listening that I knew you when you were at Bradford, when you're that young boy coming through. And I always think that one of your greatest strengths was you were the glue guy. Mm. Put Sam into a group and you'll bring everyone together. Mm. You know, I remember Tony Smith saying this about you when you first came into the national team that, you know, you'd bring in disparate parties, people sat on their own, you'd be the guy to bring them over and you'd chat with them. So the value you offered off the field was immense for what happened on it and creating team spirit and harmony. But what you're describing now is you're not just being the glue guy, you're actually being the guy that's calling people out, and you're not everybody's friend. Sometimes you've got to be the person to deliver some pretty stark messages for them. So how did you do that while still keeping that basic humanity and treating people with decency, but letting them know that they needed to up the game?
That's the hard path of leadership. You know, leadership's not a popular place. Ultimately, I put it down to this question: would you rather be my friend and lose, or would you rather just not be happy with me and win? I feel like by the time you get to that second option, the thinking, Jesus, guy's sometimes a bit hard or whatever, but you're a winner. And you probably understand, or hopefully you might understand the route that got us there. And it's actually because I cared about people. I wanted them to reach the potential. So it actually comes from a really caring place, you know.
Right.
And I always had a fair way of delivering things to people. And I was never rude or aggressive. I was just honest. And I think leadership, greatest quality you can have as a leader is being authentic. And I just always stuck by that. If I was authentic and I could stand by everything I said, then I was doing a good job. And don't get me wrong, I get it wrong at times, but I was man enough to say, listen, yeah, I'm totally wrong.
So give us an example of when you did that and then like tell us the conclusion of how that played out.
Well, in 2014, when we won the championship, I decided that I was leaving to go and play rugby union at the end of the year. So I knew I had a finish line here, and when there was a finish line in your sights, I think it's easier to make better decisions throughout the year. So I'd chosen to abstain from alcohol. I didn't want anyone to be able to say, listen, you didn't give everything that year. So, and I'd made a few commitments at the start of the year. So there's a couple of times during the year I'd be challenged with the team who I, you know, loved and cared for a lot, but I'd come for a beer and we'd play away in Gold Coast. And I was living with Ben Teo at the time, right. A great friend of mine, but he's a madman. He's mad. And he was desperate to go out for a beer in Gold Coast after we just won a game. I said, we're not going out. There's too much risk. I know you're a bit crazy, Ben. And I could see that look in his eyes. You know, he had the glares. He was fun. He was bouncing. He's already dancing. We're doing a recovery session in the pool. It's 11 o'clock at night. And he's bouncing around, splashing. I'm going for a beer. I've got my jeans. I said, no, you're not. We're not. No one's leaving the hotel. We're staying in the Gold Coast, like in the mixer. I can hear the music from the nightclubs pumping. And that's where he wanted to be. And I'll never forget, we had the whole squad sat down and the coach saying, all right, well, what are we doing? I said, no one's going out.
Right.
Not one player's going out. If you don't have a beer, stay in the hotel, you're not going. And Ben Teo stood up. He's like, mate, we're going out, Sam, just because you're not drinking. I said, no, I'm not. I don't want you to not drink. If you want to drink, have a drink. It's your prerogative. I said, you're not going out. I said, because if something goes wrong, it can derail the whole season. In the second third of the year, we were doing very well. I remember feeling at the time, I'm going, oh my God, this is not going down well. And Ben's fighting for the other 20 guys, you know, they've all said, Ben, take him on, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Take him on in front of everyone. So he's stood there going, Sam, shut up, we're going out. And I'm saying, no, you're not. No one's going out. And the coach is sort of saying, yeah, in fact, I think you should stay in. And the boys are, boo, Sam, you're boring. We're going out. I said, bottom line, not going out. I said, you'll thank me when we win. I think a few of them snuck out anyway. You know, it's like, but they had a good time, but they were behaved. You kind of put them on notice a bit, you know. And but, you know, that's one time that stands out because it was hard because I love these guys and they're working the backsides off for the team. But I knew if we stayed in and stayed out, it's another tick you're putting in your mind for when you get to that. A deep moment in the back end of the year, all those ticks, right, that you've ticked along the way, they add up and they count. So then that when that self-doubt or that lack of belief might enter your mind at the deep stage when you've got to make three tackles in a row in the 70th minute of a big final and there's no doubt saying, have I done the work? Have I made the right decisions? Because you've banked them up for like 40 weeks. So it all adds up. And that's what I was trying to get us so we were unbreakable in the mind, everyone.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Today's show is brought to you in association with Mindlift, the most personalized brain training app that can help improve your focus and your relaxation. So Mindlift is neuroscience based. And what I love about Mindlift, I've been using it for a while now, is that it's totally personalized to me. So if you're interested in optimizing your health, I would recommend you check out Mindlift. And don't just take my word for it. take the word of the elite athletes and the industry leaders who use it. So MindLift accesses brain sensing technology, games and videos that correspond to your brain's activity. Honestly, it's fascinating. You wear a smart headband which measures your brain activity and gets you a personalized routine to sharpen your mental fitness. I've been using it first thing in the morning, and genuinely, when I go into early meetings or I've got lots happening in a day, I notice the difference. I'd love you to start your personalized program at mindlift.com/high performance and you will get $40 off your first subscription. That's mindlift.com/high performance.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. You know, you think, have I really been living like that for so long? It's a bit like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. You just think, wow, how have I been affording to pay so much more? It is time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text and data for $15 a month. And the quality of their mobile service in comparison to your old provider is special. You could be saving so much money. So say goodbye to the overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, unexpected overages. You can use your own phone number, bring along all your existing contacts, and ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal, where you get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/HPP. That's mintmobile.com/HPP. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/HPP. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gig on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
I love that idea that you're saying about just a tick box, because confidence is built on evidence, isn't it? Yeah. If you believe you can do something, if you can believe you win a grand final, you've got to have the evidence that you've made the hard choices. Mm. So tell us about that mindset of the tick box, of adding up the amount of ticks is to eventually get you to a grand final.
Yeah, yeah. I just wanted, the boys used to joke around about, we do a lot of process. We had great methods and great process, but the players, oh, just ticking a box. But, you know, that ticking a box thing is actually, it does work. How I was, like, safe-proofing my mind and trying to safe-proof the team's mind was about making some good choices, right? And if you can consistently make good choices, you get in a good habit of making them, whether that be at home when you're cooking or when you're rushing around to get to an appearance and you've not really had the right nutrition and you're stopping to get a shop and there's a choice between one thing and the other and you choose the right or the better option. Once you get better at making better choices, it also translates into, in the back end of the, you know, the games, you're in habits of making good choices.
Yeah.
I'll just do my job here. I'll tie in just in case. Because for the last 9 months, you've learned to make better choices. You can't do that overnight. Did a lot of work on it myself mentally to understand that. Did a lot of meditation. I did a lot of learning about psychology of performance.
Yeah.
So it was a learned thing for myself, but I knew that if we could do it collectively, we'd have much better chance of success.
Because what you're describing there is what there's, like, the author James Clear talks about, habit stacking. Mm. That you do. So it's like that famous speech from that American general that said, "If you want to change the world, make your bed." Because the idea that if you've made your bed, you've established a sense of order that like stacks on top of each other during the day. Yeah. So tell us some of the habit, like the first easy steps that you got people doing that then led on to better habits.
Yeah, well what a lot of it started, the better habits started from away from the game. So in the preseason, we'd all have to stand up and say, okay, for the next 4 weeks, I'm going to make better choices with this part of my life. And you'd stand up, you'd say it out loud, and you'd be accountable. And it might be something silly, right? Some of the guys like drinking Coca-Cola, right? They say, well, for 4 weeks, instead of having 3 cans a day, I'm going to just have 1 can every second day of Coca-Cola. Mm. And we'd do that often, almost through the year, you know. Yeah. All right, I like ice cream on a Friday night. I'm not going to have ice cream Friday nights. But by the time Friday night came around, your body's craving for that bit of ice cream. You go to the freezer to get it. And you go, oh, wait, I've committed. you're teaching yourself to be more disciplined, and there's a greater purpose, really. And it's not about yourself, it's about a team environment. So that was a couple of things. But then within the four walls of training, our process when we entered the building, there was a lot of things to get through, right? You know, so, and it was a pain in the backside. You know, you got to get in, you got to weigh in, do all you had to, about 12 different stations you had to get through and jot down where your body's at, your stretching processes, your measurements on your all your things.
Yeah.
You know, it was a bit of a process before you got the day started. But a lot of it was about just training behaviour and making sure that you tick things off. We implemented some funny fine systems, a bit of a kangaroo court for those that missed it or didn't fill things out properly. Right. You know, so we had fun with it along the way too. We don't want it to be too regimented and not a fun environment. But those were the sort of little things that over time really added up to team success.
So what are the kind of habits that you've taken from that period of your life when you were a competitive athlete that you still do today then?
Well, I mean, I have routine. You know, me and my brothers have got a couple of businesses together. What it's given us is great structure around our business and our process of decision making, and what it's best for the business, you know. And so it's just led us into the next stage of our life and given us great habits.
Yeah.
You know, and also married with a winning mentality. I think them part together is a great thing. So it does, certainly, I look back at my career and it's going to help me for the rest of my life.
Yeah, yeah.
Without a doubt.
So let's come back to that other topic then of having a deadline.
Mm.
Because I was quite struck when you just described that period there going up to 2014. You decided you were going off to union, so you were going to leave Souths. But what I saw was the parallels that you had that deadline around your dad's illness and wanting to get into the team there. And it was almost that race against time to hit the targets. How important is a deadline?
Well, I think it's very important. Yeah. When you just put it like that, it's really important. I've never really looked at it like that before. So I think you can see it's important. Those deadlines that I've had in my career, generally, if you've got a goal in mind and there's a deadline on it, you can get there more than often. That you do put a deadline on each year. The deadline is getting to the grand final. It's funny, as you mentioned there, my two deadlines, I didn't have a choice about the result. You know, yeah. At the end of 14, I didn't see myself coming back to rugby league at the time.
Right.
So it was final, you know, and playing before my dad passed away, I had to do it because that was final, you know. And I actually did both. I hit both targets before the deadline. It's funny, I should put more deadlines on throughout my career.
No, but it's interesting because there's a finality to those two deadlines that suddenly gave you that desperation, that focus, that win at all cost mentality to get there. And I'm wondering, I suppose my question is about, for a lot of people listening to this, they're not going to have something as final as that. So sometimes it might be a longer term project they're working on. And I'm interested about how you can take the power of a deadline in situations sometimes where it might drift through, it might be a longer term project.
You've got to be careful. The power of a deadline might be too consuming too. I think that's another thing you've got to be careful of. But when I got to South Sydney, the goal was to win the premiership. You know, Russell Crowe, great friend. He's a very passionate guy, loves the club. And that was my promise to him when he bought me. I said, I want to turn your team to a winning team.
But you're 20 years old conversation.
I had a bold mind when I was it's weird. But, you know, but I knew that wasn't going to be a first-year job. I knew that.
Yeah.
I almost knew it wasn't a second-year job. I thought it might have been a third-year job.
Right.
I thought I had a chance in the third year. And then I thought the fourth year, it's here. And we should have won in the fourth, and we won it in the fifth. So it was a 5-year plan, really. But we got there in the fifth year.
Yeah, yeah.
But so that was a longer drawn out goal, essentially, really. But the finality of me leaving was, I promised this thing here. I can't fail now. So I think there is a benefit in when there isn't like a no second option or there is no other alternative. You must get the job done.
But tell us what a commitment does. So again, you're talking about making something quite public, like or you've made a promise to somebody, whether it's to your dad or whether it's to Russell Crowe, that I've made a promise and I'm not going to let you down on this. What does that do for your mindset when you make that?
Well, it makes you accountable. Like, once you're outward with your intention, you become then accountable. You know, and if you don't do it, you know, there's another saying, Jamie Peacock is a great friend of mine, is a great leader. He's really big on you deliver what you say, you know, now, because if you don't deliver on your word, then like, who are you? And I guess that was when you're outward with your intentions or with your goals, then you become accountable for that. If you're willing to do the work to get there, then I don't think there's any reason why you shouldn't be bold or have the courage to say what you believe.
Yeah. Tell us about Russell Crowe. Because he's phoning you up at 20 years of age. You're a kid from Bradford. You're getting a call from a Hollywood superstar inviting you to be part of his project.
Yeah, no, it's surreal at the time. It's funny because, I don't really get... I'm not starstruck or... I thought it was cool. At the time, I really wanted to go to the NRL. I wanted to go and play in Australia. And by chance, he'd seen me play in London. He was over filming a movie, Robin Hood, at the time in England. And he saw me play and he got my phone number somehow and called me out of the blue, which was a bit of a shock. It's weird. It's a gladiator calling me, you know. He was a very passionate man. He spoke well. He was calm. I met him, I'd say, a week or two later. I took a few of my friends down to meet him for dinner. I took my older brother, Chris Feather, Wayne Godwin, Jimmy Evans, and Dean Widders. Like, I took a gang of people down for dinner, and we just had a great night. We ended up having a lovely dinner, and we had a few beers, actually. And then we ended up prank phone calling people out of Russell's phone. It was hilarious. We were prank phone calling some of the famous.
Like who?
Yeah, we were ringing a couple of famous actors. I think we rang Shane Warne, at the time, God bless him. But, you know, we were just, Dean Widders, he's a bit of a character and good friends with Russell, so we're pranking these people in his phone. And that was my introduction to him. I thought, what a guy, you know. But then I went down a day later to the movie set he was filming in Derby at the time. I went to his trailer, and you got to think, big Hollywood movie, $250 million production. He's the main actor. Yeah, I'm a kid from Dewsbury. I come down with my mum to talk to him. They keep coming in and knocking on his door. Mr. Crowe, we're ready for you on set. Yeah, we'll be there soon. And he's saying to us, it's raining. They're not going to use me on set. And I'm getting edgy, thinking, oh my God, there's like 200 people waiting for him out there. We sat and spoke for 3 hours.
Wow.
3 hours about not necessarily rugby, not necessarily anything else. We spoke about life. As you would talk to a friend, you know, my mum and him gone very well. She was, you know, he basically was trying to comfort my mum in fact that we'll take care of your son if he comes to our club. And then when I left there, that's when we started talking business through email and trying to get a deal organised, because it was complex. I was in a contract at Bradford, but I couldn't shake my burning desire to go to Australia. So it was a hard conversation to have at the time with Steve.
And what was it about him, like, beyond the star power of his name, what was it that he was telling you that gave you that reassurance of, I want to now go and commit myself for the next 5 years?
I'll give you the totally honest answer. I was looking to go anywhere.
Right.
I wanted to go anywhere. I wanted to go and play in that league. It could have been for any club, but Russell was the guy that had the courage to take the chance. I'd been ringing Des Hasler 3 times a week on the way to training. Right. I'd ring him in the morning. I'd leave him voicemails since Sam Burgess here.
Who was Des in charge of at
the time? Manly is in charge of Manly at the time. Steve Menzies was playing at Bradford. He'd put me in touch with him. You know, but I figured that, geez, he's not really. It was a big task to get me out of my contract and to get me over to Australia. And I genuinely believe that we met for the right reasons, if there's fate or whatever it is, that me and Russell were meant to meet. And I believe he was probably the only guy that had the power, the courage, the belief and the vision to make it happen. You know, so we came into each other's lives at a perfect point. And, you know, but I wouldn't say it was him necessarily that blew me away, or the fact that, you know, the club didn't really blow me away at the time. I didn't know enough about them. But once I got in Australia, I fell in love with South Sydney almost instantly.
And is it true, I can't remember if you told me this or I've heard it, that didn't they allocate a seat in the stands with your dad's name on it?
Oh, mate, they got me off guard, caught me off guard big time.
Go on, tell us about that.
So I'd been in the country for, you know, maybe two or three months, and my profile was growing, though. And we played a trial game at Redfern, which is our spiritual home of the club of South Sydney. And they'd sold all these tickets that I was playing the game. Me and Dave Taylor, who was the other new signing, were playing the game. But I'd injured Dave Taylor in training that week, so he pulled out of the game. So I was the biggest profile player. We were playing against Manly, and it was all there. So none of their real first-grade players. But I was actually kind of nervous. They were in the press saying, oh, we want a piece of salmon. So I'm thinking, oh, here we go. You know, I've got to play this game against these kids. I don't know who they are. Can't watch any vision. I can't really review anyone. So I'm getting a bit fired up, and I can feel there's a bit of energy in the place. So I go to the stadium, and there's a good energy. Russell came down to the gym and said, come on, mate. Walks up the stairs, onto the turf. It's about maybe 50 minutes before kickoff. He walks me around the back of the sticks. I'm on the ground here. I'm looking at Redfern Terraces, the housing commission here. There's energy, people are shouting my name. And Russell just pulled out of his pocket a membership card. Oh, I'm going to get choked up. He had my father's name on it and a couple of things he used to say to me before each game. I just didn't expect it. I didn't know where it came from. And I just burst into tears on the field. And he presented it to me and he said, no, this is your father's seat in the stadium. It's next to mine. I sit here. It'll be left empty. If you're ever in doubt or you want to see him, just look to that seat. It'll be in the stadium forever. And every season, I played for the club. Oh, I didn't play for the club. That seat was always bought and purchased for my father. And then as my brothers came over to the club, he used to give each of us a membership card with my father's name on, and the quotes that my father would say to us before each game printed on the back. And it just, like, from that moment, I'm like, how can you not be connected to the club?
Yeah, yeah.
It was on the hollow turf of Redfern, and it was just a deep connection, and it just showed, I guess, who Russell was and how deep he was as a bloke and how much he thought and cared about his players. You know, for me, I was in floods of tears on the field. I'm about to kick off in 40, 50 minutes, and there's thousands of people watching me cry like a baby. And I'm like, oh my God. But it was a really overpowering, like, emotional experience that I couldn't control, but it was nice. It was real. It was authentic. You know, it was just a great touch. It was a really great touch.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, no, I struggled to get that.
Yeah, no, I know. Just tell us a little bit about him, because I know he's a friend of yours and I know he's been a mentor to you over the years. Like, what would you say has been the best piece of advice that he's passed on to you that you could share with our listeners?
I mean, with Russell, he's just such an intuitive guy. He'll always remind me to raise your vision above the horizon. Right. And, you know, when you think about it, it's always saying, you know, it's, well, the horizon's here, he said, but just raise up. It's you might see more, you know. And I think it's a great saying, raise your vision just above the horizon. And, you know, I think he's constantly throughout our 12, 13 years of friendship, he's constantly, whenever I've had a moment of self-doubt or whilst I was younger, I could have been a bit stubborn and aggressive in my approach, he would just be calm. He's lived a lot of life himself, been in some manic situations, but, you know, having that calm, constant voice throughout my life and career to just remind me to be balanced and just raise your eyes for a second, have a different look. Yeah, it's just when you close your eyes and you picture that, just raise your eyes slightly above that, just have another look.
Yeah.
I always think it's, you know, and that's probably a great bit of guidance to give me, but there's been so much. He's a man who's a fountain of wisdom and knowledge. It's like, you know, probably my greatest coach, Wayne Bennett. If you sit and ask me what's the greatest bit of advice he's ever given you, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
And like, I don't think he could tell you. It's something that you learn around those people over time. You just pick up something from them that they don't realise they're teaching you, or they don't realise that they're influencing you with. They just have this innate ability to inspire or to make you think a bit better and see things from a different perspective.
It's that famous quote, isn't it? You don't remember what they say, it's how they make you feel.
Yeah, exactly that.
Now, I'm going to ask about coaching in a minute, but I want to just check one other thing that I'll tell you who told me this, Matt King.
Oh, yeah.
Is this true that Russell Crowe once arranged that Al Pacino did a team talk for you at the Sydney Opera House where he delivered his inch by inch speech?
That's not true.
It's not true.
It's not true. You want it to be true, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
It's not. If it was, I wasn't there.
Did he bring Al Pacino in to meet, or did you arrange?
Al Pacino. I don't know if it was with Russell. I don't think he was at the football. I think it was. I met him in America. He's had some interesting books and characters come in and do some speaking. Yeah, he had some interesting people in. Yeah, but I can't remember Al Pacino.
When we're talking then about great coaches, let's talk about you've made the brave decision to come to come back to England. You're going to leave the sport that you've been reared in, rugby league, and you're going to stretch your comfort zone again to go into rugby union. What was your rationale behind that?
Well, there was a couple of things behind the decision. I'd always, at some point in my career, wanted to come and play rugby union. I'd never played before, so I didn't know the game well whatsoever. But again, I believed that I could pick it up, and I didn't think there'd be a vast change of my skill set. We'd just be trying to fine-tune that. But why I left early, maybe looking back at leaving Australia at that moment in my career, I made a choice. It was a really hard choice. Like, it was just, I believed in something and I didn't feel it was happening at the time. So I said, okay, I'm going to leave and funny enough, making that thing, well, if this doesn't change, I'm going to go. It took for me to say I'm going for it to change. I wasn't happy that it changed in that last year, my 2014 year.
What was it that you were looking to change?
At the time, the environment that we were in, there was a lot of people looking sideways about, you know, I was extremely high profile at the time in Australia, you know, so with that brought a lot of outside work or different promotions or whatever, and I felt like people were, we lost in 13, we lost again, we should have won the competition, but we lost some small margins. But, you know, and that happens in sport sometimes. And I took the loss very hard, and then I disagreed with some of the things that were said in, like when we reviewed that year, and some of the ways we managed losing and what we put losing down to. I didn't believe in that. So I challenged it, and it wasn't met. I didn't think with honesty. If I didn't have my brothers at South Sydney, I probably would have not gone back. I'd have stayed. I came and played in 2013 World Cup in England, and I just got so lost in that World Cup and so dedicated to trying to. And we had an amazing tournament. We were so close. I played some of the best games of my career in that World Cup. I just felt free. I don't know why, I've just felt out of the headlines. It was a nice place to play. I went back and said, I'll do one more year, but I'm going to rugby union. That's it. And I almost said, like, I need the decision to be made before the season kicks off, so there's no distractions through the year. I don't want the press to be able to come and have shots at us all year, and me and the team.
Yeah.
I said, let's get the deal done. We won't talk about it again. I'll be directing the press and say I will not discuss rugby union until I become a rugby union player now.
Yeah.
So don't ask me that question. If you ask me the question, I'm out. So it was a really hard line to take, but, you know, and all the sideways looking that was happening before stopped, and everyone's focus became narrow, you know, like the complaining about certain different things stopped. And, you know, so I'm not sure that would have changed if I didn't make that call.
Right, okay.
So, you know, that was one of the reasons for coming over. And then by the time it came out, I really didn't think about rugby union at all for the whole year. I was so focused on the 2014. But then when I came to rugby union, it was a great challenge than I expected. But I thoroughly enjoyed that challenge. And deciding to come and do it, I didn't realise how big the transition would be until I got here. So, and by that point, it's do or die, so.
Because what always impresses me about that, Sam, is that you've established a stellar reputation and yet you then have the courage to risk failing in something new. So how did you almost part your ego to be able to say, I'm going to learn something from scratch and I'm prepared to start at the bottom again, if you like?
It was a hard challenge. It was a hard challenge. Parting with my ego, I had enough belief in myself to make a good fist of an opportunity.
Yeah.
But it was hard. When I first came to rugby union, I'd gone from, we just won the grand final, and I played like a big role in that game, to coming and playing. When I first started playing at Bath, I was playing first team on a Saturday for 20 minutes off the bench, and then I'd play on a Monday night with the A team. But I'll never forget, I played at Exeter away on a Monday night. It would have been -1 degrees, 300 people in the stadium. And there was a guy there, I'll never forget him, he had his dog on a lead, and he came to heckle me. He paid his £10 in to watch that game just to shout at me the whole game. And I could hear everything he was saying.
Right.
It was echoing through the stadium. He said, "Burgess, you shit, you rubbish, go back to..." And I'm thinking, oh, he's right, this bloke, I should go back, what am I doing? I'm looking around, it's cold, I'm hardly touching the ball. That was hard. That was hard to manage.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but I really dived into it. I dived into it. I met a guy called Don McPherson.
Yep.
He's a psychologist, sports psychologist.
Right.
He works predominantly with, or he was at the time, predominantly with F1 car drivers. So he'd do... like visualization meditation, almost, I'd say like a hypnosis, okay?
Right.
But I was constantly, my target height approaching a breakdown was constantly too high. I couldn't change it. Muscle memory, 20 years of playing rugby league, I was used to hitting around here and coming in up tall and holding the, you know,
yeah.
To change that overnight was extremely hard. I went to meet him, I sat in his house, I sat there for 4 hours. Good conversation. I really liked his energy. He's a good man. He cared. He listened. And he said he thought he could help me. He said he had this technique where he does visualization meditation. And at the time, I'd been doing a lot of meditation, and I found it helped me enormously both as an athlete and as a human being. So I was willing to dive a bit deeper. And so we'd sit there and I'd talk him through what I wanted to change in my game, change the level of approach in contact, and he would ask me the terminology I would say to myself and how I would tell my body to do okay. That. So he'd use the words that I would use, and he would go away, he'd make a recording, and he's, you know, it's like a guided meditation recording, but it's like a 45-minute meditation. I'd put my earphones in and lay down and I'd start meditating, and before I knew it, he was talking to my subconscious, and it's like I'm seeing me attack okay. breakdowns at a lower space. I went to training the next day. Like, I hit the breakdown where I wanted to hit it at the right height. And I'm going, oh my God, that's fascinating. And what he was saying is these over a week's worth of this visualization meditation, you can almost get 10,000 hours of learning, which, I mean, you might say, I'm not sure about that, but for me, instantly it worked.
Right.
I adjusted my contact height. And I started making better progress. So I used him for a few different areas of my game that I thought were very valuable in rugby union, in the ruck.
Yeah.
You know, presenting the ball, my contact height. And it improved me out of sight. My game just like flew like that. So he actually ended up coming and working at the club with a few other players because I found him so beneficial.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So that was one thing I did. I delved deep into thinking outside the square,
yeah.
Trying to get an edge and trying to jump the ladder as quick as I could. You know, and I progressed to at Bath. I had two great centres in Kyle Eastman and Jonathan Joseph, who at the time were both playing for England in those positions. So they picked me as a flanker. So I had to start learning the game as a flanker. So, you know, I was constantly being challenged. And again, I had a deadline at the end of the season with Bath. And then it was into the World Cup year.
Yeah.
You know, we had a great year with Bath. We made the final, we made the Premiership final, and we got beat by Saracens, who were like a star-studded team. And that was my first year in rugby union. I played 80 minutes at flanker in that final and probably had one of my better games as a rugby union player. And, you know, managed to keep chipping away and managed to get in the England squad.
So when you get called up for the England squad then, how are you dealing with this? Because... as I said earlier, I've always seen you as like the glue guy. You put you in the squad and you'll bring everyone together. And yet, from an outside perspective, you're a divisive figure. Mm. You're this guy that's been drafted in from rugby league. I remember it was Luther Burrell that was dropped for you, yeah. And your name. How are you coping with being put in that polarizing position?
Yeah, I mean, you said it there from the out. It was an outside position. It wasn't. Right. It wasn't the inside position. You know, if you ask anyone that was involved in that tournament, and that's the squad that well, if people have got the courage to be honest, then it wasn't the case. You know, so it was essentially an outside position, but you know, yeah. And there are agendas, but also you know that the system and how that worked, that World Cup campaign, initially there were 50 players selected or 55 that were to be cut down to a 32 man squad. Now I quickly worked out there was 8 centres and they were only going to take 4, so then it becomes a different thing, you know, like I had to assert myself in training and performance to give the coaches confidence to select me as one of the 4. So there is a competitive edge of me in there, but in terms of a team environment, there was agenda from the outside, from the, you know, from the press or people, but it wasn't the case on the inside. So, and I never really, it's funny, when I came back to England, I wouldn't have a clue where to buy a paper or what paper to buy. So, you know, I've just never grown up reading papers. So it was never a case of I walk in the shop and look at it and see what's going on. I never knew what was really going on outside of my internal bubble.
So you've been part of, like you describe yourself, the 2013 World Cup that you play in. You've had your best game. You had that lovely phrase that you felt free and you get to the semi-finals and get narrowly beat to New Zealand. You know, you've then led a team to win the grand final. Mm. So what was different with those environments where you were successful to that England team in that World Cup campaign that ended up in being knocked out in the early stages?
Well, at the time it was glaringly obvious for me, but like I had to walk a really fine line in that environment. This was one of the hardest moments for me to manage my leadership style in that environment because I'm new to the roster, but I could see some things that were like glaringly obviously not right, but having the courage to change that so soon, it was actually a really hard position for me because I'm also trying to build relationships, earn respect, earn trust, which I didn't have. I just didn't have, and that's a long shot. And I didn't know the game well enough in terms of I'd not been around long enough to challenge some of these.
Like what? What were you seeing?
I was seeing a lot of talking behind closed doors, a lot of gossiping, you know, a lot of disrespect, which, you know, it's very hard to have success when that's going on in the background, especially through some senior players. Now, it's funny, you know, you look at that England Rugby Union squad, the coaching staff especially, you know, Stuart Lancaster, after the World Cup, he got sacked or wherever he stood down, he's gone on to Leinster. He's been the Leinster head coach for 6 years. The last 4 years have been the most dominant team in the whole of Europe. Okay, so it's not like it wasn't a great coach. Andy Farrell, who was the assistant coach, he's now head coach of Ireland. They're currently number one in the world. Yeah. Graham Rowntree, he's at Munster, and they've improved outside in the last 4 years since he's been there. And Mike Catt is off being, that was our coaching staff, the accomplished coaches have gone on into the next phase of their careers and gone on to be ultra successful, not just won a few games over here and there. Number one national team in the world, Ireland at the moment. Leinster, number one team in Europe. Graham Rowntree's taken Munster to a different place, and Mike Catt's been successful where he's been. It's like, so you had accomplished people in leadership roles, but I just don't think the players are willing to pay the price to be successful. I can sit here and say that now, and if players from that environment had the courage and the honesty to come out and say it, then I think you'd hear it from a few more people. But, you know, I think a lot of them don't like to be honest with it because it was a failed year and it was easy for them to point a finger at a few different things, you know, throughout the year. But from that campaign, there's not one bit of regret for what I gave to my country, to the team in those. Of course, I made mistakes as new to the game, but someone sent me a funny stat the other day of when, whilst playing for England Rugby Union, we were never behind on the scoreboard whilst I was on the field.
Right.
Never once, except We played against Australia at Twickenham. I was on the bench. They brought me on with 15 minutes to go and we were losing. That's the only time I was ever behind on the scoreboard. Wow. Yeah, it's funny when you think about that, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's funny, you know, like every time I went on, we were leading, and every time I started, we were winning until I was brought off the field. You know, so when I look at that, my contribution to my country and to the game, I was extremely happy with it, but essentially, I didn't love it enough. I had two trains of thought, right? When I sat in my home at Bath, the World Cup had finished. I actually had to go back and play. I played for Bath. I played one game. I got sent. I got yellow carded because I hit someone. I hit someone in the chest, and I thought it was a fair tackle, but he said the tackle was too aggressive. So I was yellow carded. I thought, oh my God, like, what am I doing? Like, do I really want to be here? Like, it's just a constant battle for my mind in terms of it's not who I am. You know, but then there was the other side of me saying, no, Sam, stay here, come back, captain the country, lead them to like the next World Cup. But I was doing that to prove people that I really didn't care about as much wrong. Yeah, I wasn't doing it for me or for the reasons that I really value. Yeah. You know, I wasn't doing it, you know, and I had this like epiphany that I was sat in my bath at home and I thought, geez, my career's really short. You get, if you're lucky, 15 years in the seat. I don't want to spend 5 years somewhere that I'm actually not enjoying it 100%. So I made a pretty harsh decision to get back in the NRL and close to my family as soon as I could.
Wow.
Yeah.
But that almost takes you back to the very start of being around people that you love, people that you care about, and on a mission to make yourself happy. Mm. And that's pretty much a great place to go into our quickfire questions then, Sam. So we always wrap up the interview with some quickfire questions. So what are the three non-negotiables that you and the people around you must buy into?
I think being your authentic self is very important. It's got the most, you can hold that forever. It's yourself. I think work ethic. If you have a good work ethic, you can manage most problems and you can become better. And I'd say honesty. If you can be honest with yourself and you can be honest with your team. So I think if you combine those three things together, you can really have a good chance of reaching your potential.
What advice would you give to a teenage Sam just starting out on his journey?
just take a breath. Take a breath every now and then. You know, I remember whilst I was younger, sometimes I could be very quick to make a decision. You know, I don't regret that. I don't regret the decisions I made. I stand by most of them. Just raise your eyebrows above the horizon every now and then.
If you could go back to one moment in your life, what would it be and why?
If I could go back and just sit there in that conservatory for one more day, just sit there with my dad and sort of tell him about the last 15 years, really, tell him about my brothers. And so, I mean, without getting too deep, that's where, if you give me one day, I go back to that one day.
How important is legacy to you?
It never was. I never thought of it, but now I guess I'm retired. I guess I think it was a really important part of my mindset. You know, I didn't really ever think this is what I want to leave behind. Oh, this, you know, this is what I want to create. But when I look back, I think actually I was creating it. I was trying to create a legacy. So I do think, you know, I think it's important, yeah.
And the final question is, what's your one golden rule to live a high-performance life?
Being authentic. Being authentic and honest with yourself, and then you can really maximise your potential.
Brilliant. Well, thanks, Sam. It's been a privilege.
No, thanks, Damien. Thanks for having me on. It's great.
Well, it's a little bit of a different wrap-up this week because I've not got Jake with me, but I still think it's worth us just doing a reflection on the incredible lessons that Sam shared with us in that conversation. And there's a number of things I'd like you, having listened to it, just to maybe reflect on yourself. So the first one was the distinction between confidence and belief. And Sam spoke really powerfully about building good habits and identifying those moments when you just tick a box in your head. And when you do that for when it doesn't count, you know that when it does, you already have the resources and the ability in the bank. It's that phrase that I frequently use on the podcast of confidence is built from evidence, So we have to look for moments where that evidence is there, store it so that we can call on it in the moments when it really does matter. There's another point that Sam made to us there about the importance of his dad was putting him through a masterclass in the lessons needed to grow up. And I think there's something powerful for that, for all of us that are parents, and the way that we're teaching our children the skills that they're going to need as adults. I think there was something really quite profoundly moving about Sam's final message around the fact that his dad taught him to care and to love for others. There was another really important point that I think is worth dwelling on, was just the ability to be a sponge in any environment. Sam spoke about how he was learning from his dad and his illness, but he also spoke about going into that dressing room for the first time and going in there just with a quiet humility to soak up as much information as he could that could teach him the lessons that he eventually took with him when he reached the summit of his sport. And then the final point I'd like to just reflect on is that relentlessness that he had in terms of going looking for feedback when he was knocking on the manager's door, finding out what he needed to do next and then applying it. There's something there for all of us to be able to take away in our own lives, that nobody's the finished article, that there's always something that we can learn. But the important point is being open to the lessons from it. I'm really grateful for those of you that have made the time to listen to these specials. So rugby league's an incredibly special sport with, as you've heard today, some incredibly special people in it. And over the next few weeks, we'll be meeting some more of these characters who've got some incredible lessons to share with us. So I'll look forward to sharing the next one coming soon.
Well, look, I really hope you enjoy that. Don't forget, if you want more from the High Performance Podcast, you can watch the episodes on YouTube, always worth doing. You can buy our book. We've got our journal coming out very shortly. We're going on tour next year. And if you want to get information about all of that stuff, just go to thehighperformancepodcast.com. That's thehighperformancepodcast.com. And you can find it all. But huge thanks to Sam Burgess for coming on and speaking so emotionally and so honestly with Damien. Of course, thanks to Damien for hosting such an amazing conversation. Thanks to the whole team behind the podcast. We're back with another Rugby League World Cup special very soon. But remember, there is no secret. It is all there for you. So chase world-class basics. Don't get high on your own supply. Remain humble, curious, and empathetic. And we'll see you very soon.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.